Good morning. I'm Anthony Noble, registration number 33910, and I represent the appellant, Oscar Arona-Hernandez. The issue before the court is whether the district court erroneously denied the post-conviction motion filed in this case without an evidentiary hearing. Mr. Arona-Hernandez came to this country when he was a child. He came here with his mother and his sister to live with his father, who was already living in the country. He became a lawful permanent resident. He went to school in this country. He was employed in this country. At the time that he entered the guilty plea in this case, he had lived in the country for over 15 years. He had no intention to return to Mexico, where he came from. And he pleaded guilty to prohibited use of a weapon, a firearm, which is a Class 2 misdemeanor. About 4 years after pleading guilty, he was taken into immigration custody and removal proceedings were initiated. At that time, he consulted with an immigration attorney on his removal case, and he determined that he may have been denied effective assistance of counsel in this case and in another case in Adams County. I think his immigration attorney advised him that he wasn't advised of the immigration consequences of his guilty plea, and that may amount to ineffective assistance of counsel. So his family retained me to represent him in both Boulder County in this case and in his Adams County case, and I filed petitions for post-conviction relief in both cases. In this case, there was a time bar issue because he pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor and he only had 18 months after the guilty plea to file his 35C. So I alleged that there was justifiable excusable neglect for the late filing of the petition. And the basis of that allegation was our Supreme Court's decision in Widema, which says that if a person doesn't know that his conviction is constitutionally infirm or had no reason to question its validity, then that could amount to justifiable excusable neglect. In this case, he didn't have any reason to question the validity of the conviction or know that there was a constitutional infirmity until the removal proceedings were initiated and his immigration attorney informed him that he may have been denied effective assistance of counsel.
Go ahead. Would not Mr. Arona have had a reason to question the validity of his conviction because there was a time limit within which he could do so?
Well, if he'd known of the time limit, he'd also then have to know that there was some kind of infirmity with the conviction. As far as he was concerned, it was a legitimate conviction, he was given effective counsel, and it wasn't until the removal proceedings were initiated that he became aware that he'd actually been denied effective assistance of counsel because he'd been given absolutely no advice on the immigration consequences of that conviction.
Now, let me ask you about that, because it seemed to me that he was at least advised in the taking of the plea of potential immigration consequences. Was that not correct?
That's correct. He did sign a plea agreement.
So if that's correct, he was at least aware of potential problems, because this whole the time bar certainly turns on his awareness.
That's assuming that he read and understood the plea agreement.
Well, the judge went through it.
That's correct, and the judge in the Cazardi case also went through the plea agreement, or the counsel went through the plea agreement. And in the Cazardi case, almost an identical advisement on the immigration consequences was given, but another division of this court ruled that that didn't disprove prejudice, that he still gets an evidentiary hearing.
Well, now we're not talking about the prejudice problem, we're talking about excusable neglect. That's a completely different issue, isn't it?
It's similar in this case, because if the advisement doesn't disprove prejudice, then why would it disprove justifiable excusable neglect? Surely there still has to be an evidentiary hearing so that we can determine what his understanding of that plea agreement was. We also need to determine what counsel...
For purposes of excuse... I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't want to keep focusing on the excusable neglect, because your argument, it seems to me, goes back into the Strickland prongs, and I'm thinking.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that, you know, they're very closely related But I think, if anything, we have a less of a burden when it comes to justifiable excuse, excusable neglect. Our Supreme Court in the close case has said that the allegations have to be considered to give the overriding concern is to give the defendant a meaningful opportunity to challenge his conviction. And that's definitely didn't happen here. All the judge did was
why didn't it happen here?
Because
he had a meaningful opportunity within 18 months, within the term provided in the statute, to challenge his conviction.
Although he had no reason to question the validity of his conviction during that 18-month period.
That was because of his ignorance of the law?
But it was because that he didn't realize.
You're saying excusable neglect is created by ignorance of the law?
Well, there's a distinction between ignorance of the law and this court's precedent on justifiable excuse, excusable neglect. In all of those cases that I've cited in the reply brief on ignorance of the law, it's really ignorance of the procedure, ignorance of the procedures in the Rule 35C, ignorance of the time bar. It's not ignorance of a constitutional infirmity with the conviction. That's one of the Wadima factors that the Supreme Court has said a court must consider or should consider to determine whether there's justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. So his ignorance of the constitutional infirmity with his conviction is justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. It's not ignorance of the law in the same way that this court has determined that other factors can be ignorance of the law when it comes to justifiable excuse, excusable neglect. So there's a distinction between this ignorance of the constitutional infirmity, which can amount to justifiable excuse or excusable neglect, and ignorance of 35C procedures, which this court has said, the Supreme Court hasn't issued an opinion on that yet, has said that that kind of ignorance does not amount to justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. So that's the distinction that the district court failed to make in this case. It didn't go through the Wadima factors in its order, and then it kind of conflated this knowledge that there may be immigration consequences with knowledge that there's an infirmity with the conviction. The advisement in the plea agreement did not advise Mr. Aaron Hernandez that there was an infirmity with that conviction. Didn't advise him, didn't give him any reason to question the validity of that conviction. And it wouldn't, because the whole purpose of that plea agreement and the providency hearing is to validate the plea agreement and the conviction. So he had no idea when he left that courtroom that there was any constitutional infirmity with his conviction. And it wasn't until the removal proceedings were initiated and that his immigration attorney told him that there's a problem with that conviction that he then realized that he had this remedy under Rule 35C. He retained counsel and pursued post-conviction relief in both cases. So that's the problem with the district court's ruling, is that it didn't address this Wadima factor of whether or not he had knowledge of the constitutional infirmity with his conviction. The court, in its order denying post-conviction relief, also didn't address the Strickland prongs, whether counsel's performance was deficient or whether Mr. Aaron Hernandez was prejudiced by that deficient performance. In this case, he alleged that his attorneys didn't give him any advice at all about the immigration consequences of pleading guilty in this case. And in Padilla, the U.S. Supreme Court said that when the deportation consequences are truly clear, then the obligation on defense counsel is to give correct and accurate advice. So even if you look at the advisement that was given in the plea agreement and somehow that may cure any neglect on counsel for not giving any advice, that advisement alone is not sufficient. It's not sufficient under Padilla. Padilla said that an attorney can give advice that there may be immigration consequences when those consequences are not clear. But in this case, the consequences of prohibited use of a weapon are truly clear in the immigration statutes. A defense attorney doesn't have to go further than those immigration statutes to determine that Someone that pleads guilty to prohibited use of a weapon is presumptively and mandatorily removable.
What should counsel have said to your client then in this case to have avoided the constitutional infirmity of which you speak?
Counsel should have advised Mr. Arona Hernandez that pleading guilty to this conviction in this case will make you deportable. It's mandatory, it's presumptive. And not only...
Well, but we don't know whether counsel did or did not make such an advisement. This is only an allegation stage.
Yes, but at this stage, Your Honor, you have to accept those allegations as true.
I understand.
You have a de novo review, the same review that the court has. And the Supreme Court has pronounced in numerous cases that those allegations are true at this point. And the court, the district court, should have accepted those allegations as true, granted an evidentiary hearing, and then determined the credibility of Mr. Arona Hernandez and his defense attorneys to determine what advice actually was given. But at this stage of the proceedings, those allegations were true, and no advice was given on the immigration consequences of this conviction.
Mr. Noble, let me ask you this. How do you reconcile your argument with the holding in People versus Slusher?
I'm not sure of the holding in Slusher, Your Honor.
Slusher is an opinion of another division of this court. Let me read a part of it. Part of it says, even assuming that defendant had rights under the UMDDA, that his former counsel failed to advise him of those rights, and that he did not discover the issue until 1998, which was past the time limits for filing the 35C, these circumstances do not excuse his delay in raising a post-conviction, raising the issue.
So in Slusher, was the court holding that that he wasn't aware of a constitutional infirmity in the conviction until later on, which was past the time bar? Because if so, then how is that reconciled with our Supreme Court's ruling in Wadima and the following cases, which say that ignorance of a constitutional infirmity is a factor that may amount to justifiable excusable neglect? So that really is the question. I'm not that familiar with that Slusher case, but it's clearly a factor for the court to consider whether or not the defendant was aware that his conviction was constitutionally infirm. If he wasn't aware, then that can amount to justifiable excusable neglect.
Isn't that theory going to just swallow the rule of itself? I mean, it's going to make the time limitation within the statute unimportant. Someone can say, well, I've discovered now that my conviction may have been constitutionally infirm, so now that's the justifiable excuse for me to be able to file a 35C past the time limitations in the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, that's one of the factors that the Supreme Court has said that has to be considered. Now, we could turn the tables and say that isn't this court's precedent on justifiable excusable neglect, doesn't that just completely wipe out that exception? Because I'm not aware of a single published opinion in which this court has found any factor other than ineffective assistance of counsel to amount to justifiable excusable neglect. So what's the point of having that exception to the time bar if it's not given any teeth? So in this case, the court didn't apply the Redeemer factors. We sufficiently alleged justifiable excusable neglect in the petition for post-conviction relief. On that basis, the court should have given us an evidentiary hearing. So I'd ask the court to reverse the order denying post-conviction relief and remand this case for an evidentiary hearing. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Emmy Langley, registration number 39075, and I represent the people in this matter. The defendant is not entitled to an evidentiary hearing in this case. He argues he has established justifiable excuse because he did not know his conviction was infirm until he was taken into ICE custody, invoking the third factor of the Weimer case. But right off, I want to point out that there were 10 months from when he was picked up by ICE and when he filed this motion, and he doesn't provide an explanation for why that period of time should be excused.
Without reaching the excusable neglect piece of this, be a problem in your
I think no, because I think this case is a lot different than the Cazzotti case. In the Cazzotti case, the one issue that the court reached the merits on was a misdemeanor, and the Rule 11 was a felony advisement. So the court noted that and thought that the advisement was deficient partially on those grounds. Also, if you read the Padilla case, Padilla uses the words, the phrases such as presumptive mandatory and possible deportation. Here, the Rule 11 advisement said could, and I don't think the defendant has distinguished why could versus what Padilla says, possible deportation, would really change why he would have not accepted the plea agreement.
So it doesn't mean that if deportation is hard to tell him, it's mandatory, it's not maybe.
Well, I think here it's presumptively mandatory. This is not, I think the closest you can get to being mandatory from my understanding of immigration law is an aggravated felony, and this was not an aggravated felony. So here he has a lot of, from what I understand, and my understanding of immigration law is very limited, he has the ability to move for cancellation of removal. There's a Bureau of Immigration Appeals, and then even after that, his country that of citizenship still has to pay for him to be deported into the country. So I don't think that this is a case where the Rule 11 advisement or the immigration or the plea counsel had to tell him you will be deported, because that just isn't true in this case.
Well, wouldn't he have to say you're presumptively deportable then?
I mean,
other than just the broad what was given here.
Well, I think my distinction is I'm not really sure, A, how presumptively deportable is different than could be deported. And I think they both say that...
You don't think one's a little stronger than the other?
I mean, if you think so,
I'm asking you. I mean...
PDA also goes on to say possible deportation, too, so I...
But if he's challenging the constitutional basis of this ineffective assistance, let's assume counsel said nothing and we have to only rely on what the judge advised at the plea versus nothing else. Isn't there a difference between the presumptively deportable?
I mean the difference is how, I mean, I guess there's a difference in the words, yes, but...
Well, no, I mean, just to a defendant sitting in the courtroom. I mean, don't you think that in the 35C motion is saying there is a difference? So we have to assume if that's proven, would that amount to an effective assistance?
Well, I think that even assuming it amounts to deficient performance, I'm not sure that the defendant can explain how it would prejudice him, because he hasn't asserted how... could be deported changed versus knowing that deportation would presumptively occur how it specifically changed his mind about whether he would accept the plea and proceed to trial. And also, I think notably, even though he asserts that he was not advised at all by his attorney, the Rule 11 is signed by plea counsel that says, I went over every part of this Rule 11 with the defense, so his claims are refuted by the record in that regard. And then as far as the justifiable excuse claim for that period before he was picked up by ICE, as you stated earlier, Judge Furman, I think he was on notice that he could be deported. He hasn't argued that my attorney told me this. I relied on this. And
well, he was on notice as of when?
As he was on notice when he pled guilty that he could be deported. And he hasn't said why his reliance on the word could precluded him from researching the issue further before he was picked up by ICE. And then there's also that 10 months that after he's picked up by ICE that he has an established justifiable excuse or excusable neglect for.
I understand Mr. Noble's argument is that if defendant's conviction is constitutionally infirm, it's a different scenario. It's one in which defendant may not have to investigate further the language of the Rule 11 advisement about the possibility of being deported. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think I would say I'm not assuming that his conviction was infirm because based on what he argues that he was, you know, deportation was of the utmost concern for him, he was on notice when he pled guilty that he could be deported, and he hasn't established why could precluded him from researching the issue further until he was picked up by ICE. And then also,
well, he wouldn't establish it till a hearing. He's alleging there is a difference. You don't think he is alleging there's a difference?
Well, I'm even assuming that there is a difference. I'm not sure that there's he has established why the specific difference would have changed, you know, would have made his conviction infirm, because he says that, you know, deportation was of the utmost concern for him, and he hasn't distinguished why those specific semantics would have changed his, you know, reason for not looking into his conviction or, you know, making his conviction infirm from the point that he...
But wasn't the problem in the Padilla case that reached the U.S. Supreme Court that the defendant Padilla also had been told there was a possibility as opposed to it would be mandatory, and defendant, exact same situation as Mr. Padilla then?
I think in Padilla he was told incorrectly, but the court does go on to say that it doesn't matter whether you're told incorrectly or not told incorrectly. But Padilla only talks about Strickland. It doesn't address the justifiable excuse, which I think is the main issue in this case.
I do want you to address the justifiable excuse, and I know that you have been, but as you know, I started off asking you if this would be a Padilla case were it not for the justifiable excuse piece of it, and you've been quibbling, you've been arguing that point
well, I think,
throughout the argument.
If we were going to address the merits of the case, my argument would still be that he can't establish prejudice in this case because he hasn't been able to explain how knowing that deportation may occur or could occur versus knowing that deportation would have presumptively occurred would have changed his decision on whether to accept the plea offer. And also, his assertion that he wasn't advised at all is refuted by the record. So that would be my response to the merits of the argument.
Okay, now let's move forward. Now, could you explain for me the difference between prejudice, Fusan, the Kazadi case, and justifiable neglect, which is the standard in this case?
Well, I think the justifiable excuse and excusable neglect is a lesser burden, or I mean, is a greater burden for the defense. If you look at the standard of review, it's more of a abuse of discretion standard than the 35C standard, which is de novo. And I think that you just have to have some awareness that a situation may occur or that your conviction is possibly infirm. You don't, and then you, as long as that happens, then I don't think under the third prong of the Weidemer factors, you cannot establish justifiable excuse. And then I mean, I know I keep saying this, but those 10 months after he was picked up by ICE and before his motion was filed, he hasn't explained.
Well, that doesn't wait with... It seems to me that if at some point he becomes aware of an infirmity that he was not aware of before, that would trigger some kind of a time limit, wouldn't it?
I don't know if it would trigger a 10-month time limit, especially...
Oh, I mean, who knows?
I think... Well, I think that the case law says that you have to find the reason for the entire period that you're late. And I also think here was 18 months was his time limit, and he doesn't explain 10 months of it. I think that's... And this was not a 3-year versus 10 months, I think, because his time limit was 18 months. I mean, 10 months is pretty significant that he doesn't explain. Are there any more questions? I ask that you affirm the trial court. Thanks.
I am not a United States citizen. I could be deported. It's unlikely that I will be deported, but I could be deported. Now, if I pulled out a gun and pointed at you and I was convicted, then I would be deported. Based on my present status, I've bought a house, started a business, got married, made this my home. If I was going to be deported, my plans would be completely different. That's the distinction between could and would. It's a huge distinction, and many courts and other jurisdictions have recognized that. Now, with regard to waiting 10 months, I'm not sure if any of you have ever represented a person in post-conviction proceedings, but it takes time. It takes time for defendants to come up with the money. It takes time to obtain the transcripts, to obtain the court record. Sometimes it can be done quickly. Sometimes there are inherent delays. But it's still 10 months within...
Is that all in the motion to establish justifiable excuse?
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you.
Your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.